Payday Loan Fixes, the fast-growing business of music festivals, and the return of the commune. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, June 2nd. Glad to be with you today. In this world, there are never easy solutions. For example, it is generally agreed that payday loans are bad. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is out today with a plan to change up that industry. The plan would require lenders to make sure people can pay back the loans they get without having to take out new ones. But somehow, even supporters found something to complain about in the 1,300-page proposal. From Washington, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Like most regulations, there are those who are happy with the proposed rules, those who aren't, and then those who are in between. Marisabel Torres of the National Council of La Raza is mostly in the happy camp.
It's a positive step that will help to eliminate bad actors and predatory products from the lending marketplace. So we're pretty excited about this rule. Been a long time coming.
But she says this draft of the rule comes with too many loopholes, like exempting some loans from requirements to make sure borrowers can actually pay the money back.
Without exceptions, you should be able to repay a loan if you take it out and still meet all of your other basic financial obligations, pay for your basic living expenses.
The Pew Charitable Trust wants more consumer protection in this area. Alex Horwitz, a researcher for the group, is less than impressed with what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau released today.
The CFPB ended up focusing mostly on process, underwriting, how a lender should document a loan. But what borrowers care about is dollars and small installment payments.
He says the proposed rules will still allow payday lenders to charge super high interest on loans, just with more paperwork. But that paperwork might be enough to put some lenders out of business.
This is resource prohibitive for most providers of this type of lending, whether they be a bank or a non-bank.
David Pomeran is with the Consumer Bankers Association, which represents banks.
And quite honestly, the cost would add greatly to the cost of the loans themselves, so making them rather cost prohibitive to offer.
Which also means that if some lenders go out of business, bigger banks won't step in to replace them. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Uber, the ride-sharing company that is quite literally trying to take over the world, is getting a big check from a new investor. Not some Silicon Valley VC. Oh, no. It's from Saudi Arabia. That country's public investment fund is putting $3.5 billion into Uber. It's being called one of the largest single investments in a private startup. Of course, Uber is not a typical startup. It's operating in 400 cities in 70 countries, and it shows no sign of going public. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more on Uber's fundraising strategy.
Uber raising a bunch of money might sound familiar. Matthew Wong tracks investment in private companies for CB Insights. Uber keeps him busy.
Since the start of 2015, I think we tracked 11 different instances of funding announcements where new investors have entered, where we saw, you know, Times Internet announce that they're investing, China Life, Tata, Baidu, Toyota, Saudi Arabia being the latest. So that's certainly almost unprecedented for private companies.
It's clearly a very exciting space that's drawn an unbelievable amount of investment, says Max Wolf. He's chief economist at Manhattan Venture Partners. But this latest investment also tells another story, in part because it came from this unusual source, Saudi Arabia.
So further afield in every sense, in terms of who normally invests in these things, in terms of geography, and in terms of sort of who's on the cutting edge of technology.
He says that, plus the fact that the company's valuation didn't increase, shows that the investment money might not be flowing as freely as it has been.
It's gotten quite a bit harder, even for the highest flyers like Uber, to raise money in the space.
But he also thinks the company's unlikely to go public, especially while private investors are still willing to write checks. But with that money getting harder to come by, Uber may be trying to sock away cash now while it still can.
Absolutely, right? This is the squirrel that's trying to fill the larder for the winter here.
I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Must be a weekend in the summer because there's a big music festival on the agenda. The Governor's Ball starts tomorrow in New York City featuring Kanye West, The Strokes, L. King, and many others. The three-day event is going to be big business, just like most of the other 800 music festivals that have sprung up in recent years all over the U.S. And it's not just festival organizers that benefit. Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
Jess Silberstein works in entertainment in Atlanta. At 30, she's been going to festivals for half her life. She says there's something different about a festival than a concert, the way the experience draws her together with other attendees. A few years ago, she went to Lollapalooza in Chicago.
And Arcade Fire was the headliner, and there was just this moment at the end. It was the last night of the festival, and they played Wake Up, and you have 30,000 people all singing the song together. And it just, I don't know, it gave me chills.
She's taking in three festivals this year and crossing the country for one of them. Don Gorder chairs the Music Business and Management Department at Berklee College of Music. He says the sheer number of people makes festivals lucrative for the organizers and others.
Sponsors love it because it gives great visibility. They position themselves well with their banners and their product placements and sponsoring the meet and greets and that kind of thing.
They often have that captive audience for a couple of days. But festivals don't only help those directly involved. Megan Beyer lives in Chicago. She owns an apartment she rents on Airbnb. When Lollapalooza comes around, her place is in hot demand.
I will book same day, within an hour of ticket sales.
And she usually decides?
Maybe take my price up just a tiny bit, just to take advantage of it a little bit.
25 to 50% more. After all, she has to make up for that unmarketable Chicago winter. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a nice little rebound ahead of tomorrow's jobs report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so tell me if this sounds familiar. You drive for a living, you lease or own your vehicle, and while you do work for the company that pays you, you're not technically an employee. Yeah, it turns out this model predates Uber and Lyft. Truck drivers have been operating this way for years, and now some of them are on strike at a pair of the nation's busiest ports, trying to force a conversation about what it means to be an employee these days. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that story.
Every day, as many as 25,000 short-haul trucks trek to and from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. They're transporting containers filled with goods that end up in stores like Walmart, Target, and Costco. Most of the drivers aren't employees of a transport company. They lease or own their trucks, so they're classified as independent contractors. And a lot of them say that's not the way it should be. The California Labor Commission has seen more than 800 complaints filed against port trucking companies in the last 5 years. Jorge Mayorga has been driving a truck in Southern California for more than 30 years. He calls the situation an illusion of independence because, sure, he can make his own hours.
But we never has the possibility to make some contract with a customer directly. The company did.
In the reality, they work for one trucking company.
Nick Weiner is in charge of the Justice for Port Drivers campaign.
There's really no functional difference, regardless of the label, of how that driver does their work.
But it's a lot cheaper for the company. It's not on the hook for benefits or insurance. About 750 trucking companies work out of the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Most of them have fewer than 100 trucks. Rich Pianca is acting general counsel for American Trucking Associations. He says the majority of litigation, especially in California, is ruling on the side of drivers, and that could be a problem for the industry.
The downside of all this is, you know, it's sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And if you go and you talk to drivers who have chosen the owner-operator model, they will tell you overwhelmingly that they want to be an owner-operator because they want to run their own small business.
He says if drivers wanted to get jobs as employees with benefits, they could. James Johnson used to be an employee driver. Now he leases a truck from Fox Transportation. He says he makes more money driving for himself, but he also has to hustle.
It's a business. It might be you drive, like me, I drive this truck. I don't have any other drivers, so I'm responsible for me. If I don't take care of my business, it's not anybody else's fault.
Jonathan Rosenthal is chairman of Total Transportation Services based in Los Angeles. He abandoned the independent contractor model a few years ago because he said he could see what was coming. The California Labor Commissioner has awarded more than $35 million to drivers since 2011. He says he's willing to pay more for drivers right now to avoid the risk of lawsuits.
What people are not contemplating when they think about an independent contractor model is not just how much I'm paying my driver and how much it costs me to operate the business, but how am I amortizing the cost of that litigation? Because that litigation is going to ensue one way or another.
For Rosenthal, giving up the owner-operator model was a business decision. But he also admits he likes that he has more control over how these drivers are treated.
In a very fragmented business, people are going to get taken advantage of. And there is no question in my mind that some drivers have been taken advantage of.
I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The country of Sierra Leone relies on fishing for about 10% of GDP. But here's the problem. It outsources a lot of that fishing to farms, mostly from Asia, who trawl the waters without reporting or regulation. And that unmanaged, large-scale industrial fishing has gotten Sierra Leone in some trouble. It got a yellow card from the European Commission last month, meaning it's close to being listed as, quote, uncooperative in helping to curb illegal fishing. The BBC's Marie Keyworth has been investigating the issue, starting at the coastal village of Tombo.
It's just gone 6 p.m. and the boats here at Tombo have now come in with the day's catch.
The women are now negotiating the price.
Michael Benga is the village secretary general. Tombo is the largest fishing community in Sierra Leone, and this kind of artisanal fishing is critical to the country. It directly or indirectly employs over 200,000 people, but livelihoods are being damaged by the problems caused by illegal fishing.
The industrial fishing, which are using the trawlers, they fish right inshore.
Foreign trawlers are frequently spotted operating illegally in Sierra Leone's inshore exclusion zone.
The trawlers damage our fishing nets. When this happens, our families suffer. We can't pay for food. We can't afford school fees.
The government's fishing ministry says it's doing what it can to monitor fishing in its waters. This includes having observers who are stationed on board the foreign boats to make sure they don't stray. But Dr. Sally Sanko, an academic and West Africa fisheries coordinator working with the Sierra Leone government, says the system is entirely open to abuse.
These observers are paid by the industry, not by the government. And so we suspect that there is a lot of underreporting. They are using the captain's radio on board the vessel to report. They are reporting with the captain sitting on top of their head. What would they say?
Now, these are all issues with licensed boats. Illegal fishing vessels are even harder to track. There's only one patrol boat, which is often without fuel. And when you go down to the maritime monitoring station, there's a further problem.
This is the Joint Operations Center. Here, all the actions take place in terms of monitoring vessels' activity.
Victor Carbo is head of the monitoring unit at the Ministry of Fishing and shows me around the dark and silent facility.
None of these computers seem to be on.
Yeah, they are not on because of power.
While Victor Carbo waits, the World Bank says Sierra Leone has twice as many licensed boats than its fishing grounds can handle sustainably. Until the authorities can get a grip on industrial fishing in its waters, it will be the local people, like those in Tombo, who suffer.
That was the BBC's Marie Keyworth in Tombo, Sierra Leone. Coming up.
Actually, when you do have a larger group, you get to have an easier lifestyle in some senses.
Communal living is making a comeback. But first, let's do the numbers. Numbers are up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 48 points, a quarter percent, to end at 17,838. The NASDAQ rose 19 points, 0.4% to close at 4971. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, about a quarter percent, to end at 2105. Johnson & Johnson jacked up 1.5%. The health and personal care company has agreed to buy hair products maker Vogue International for more than $3 billion. Energy stocks slid as OPEC failed to set oil production caps at the oil cartel's meeting in Vienna. Apparel retailer L Brands, owners of Victoria's Secret, advanced 4.25% after reporting strong sales figures. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.80%. And you are listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. For as much as you hear about cage-free eggs, it seems like all the chickens should be running free by now. A long list of grocery chains, restaurants, food manufacturers, and distributors have pledged to switch to cage-free eggs. And animal rights groups have lobbied hard to get hens out of conventional cages, where the space to move around is about the size of an iPad. But only about 10% of production is now cage-free. Marketplace's Annie Baxter checks in with a couple of Midwestern farmers.
Here's a rather staggering statistic. The USDA estimates that to meet current and future demand for cage-free eggs, we're going to need about 175 million cage-free hens. And right now, we only have about 18 million. Making up all that slack might require getting farmers like Ammon Bear on board.
I'm down here at the poultry show this week, and I'll be looking at equipment, cage-free equipment versus caged equipment.
Bear and I recently met up near a poultry convention in St. Paul. He's a producer in northern Minnesota. He and his relatives together have more than a million layer hens. And the fact that Bear was going to scope out cage-free systems seemed like a big deal. His family has used cages since 1965, and Bear has publicly spoken out against any attempts to make farmers ditch cages. This has made him no friend of the Humane Society.
I would ask how many of those people in the Humane Society that are advocating for it have grown up in the egg business and actually taken care of birds and livestock.
Bear has a lot of reservations about going cage-free. For one thing, he says your bird mortality rates are higher.
When you have thousands of birds in a building on the floor, they have access to run all around. They can be cannibalistic and kill each other, and they do so.
In cage-free housing, you need more workers managing the flock. That can mean higher labor costs. There can be a big capital investment. You might need new buildings to keep as many hens. And feed costs spike. When hens move around more, they eat more, especially in systems called aviaries, where the hens can move up and down onto different levels. Researchers estimate aviary costs run 30 to 40% higher than conventional cages. Ammon Bear was skeptical the math would work out for him.
I'm getting too close to retirement to make that kind of a commitment investment, because that's going to take 15 or 20 years to get the money back out of it.
Bear and others also worry that consumers won't like having higher costs passed on to them. A carton of large conventional eggs retails for about $1 a dozen. Cage-free eggs, more like $3 a dozen. A tiny slice of the cage-free supply comes from Lauren Gady and his son Joel in Wisconsin. They have 10,000 hens.
You know, never even considered a cage facility. You know,
The idea of having chickens in cages didn't excite either one of us.
The Gady's farm goes back a couple generations, and they still get help from Lauren's 81-year-old mom, Marlene, who serves up a big daily meal.
Spare ribs.
Ooh, those look good.
The Gady's keep their hens in two houses. In one of them, Joel points to roosts along the walls. They kind of look like ladders, and the birds can fly onto them. Joel says the roosts help keep the hens from getting bored and pecking at each other, the kind of thing Ammon Bear was worried about.
You're looking at 5,000 chickens, and for the most part, they seem to be getting along pretty well.
The Gady's eggs are not just cage-free, they're also organic. The hens get outdoor access and organic feed, which is expensive, so organic eggs cost more than both conventional and run-of-the-mill cage-free eggs. But the co-op the Gady's belong to, Organic Valley, says demand for those eggs is outpacing supply. It wasn't clear that would be the case when the Gady's built their hen houses back in 2003.
There wasn't no guaranteed market like there was today. You know, it was a huge leap of faith.
Hello.
I recently checked in with Ammon Bear to see if he would make a leap of faith and go cage-free. He said no, partly because there's still no common standard for what counts as cage-free.
What happens if I put in $40 a bird into these aviary systems, and 5 years down the road, some certifying organization says, well, we no longer accept that, that's not good enough?
With those kinds of uncertainties about standards and costs hanging over producers, it's really no surprise many big food companies are giving themselves 5 to 10 years to deliver on their cage-free commitments. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
If you're a 20-something, maybe even a 30-something, looking for your first apartment and thinking, man, I wish I didn't have to buy my own groceries or set up internet access or live alone, have I got a trend alert for you. Co-living is back. Several new startups, in fact, are promising real estate with a built-in social life and lots of perks. These companies are part property manager, part dorm parent. I visited a house in Oakland run by a local startup called Open Door to see what it's actually like to co-live. Ooh, it smells really good in here.
Yeah.
What are you guys making?
Fennel and carrots roasted in brown sugar and mustard.
Oh my gosh.
And Parmesan cheesy grits.
I was convinced to go along with the beef option once I found out it was carbon negative beef.
That's like exactly what I would expect from co-living dinner.
Mm-hmm. We actually bought a half cow directly from the ranch.
You bought a half cow?
We bought a half cow. And then we picked it up from the butcher shop, and it's in our giant freezer downstairs.
Okay. My name is Jay Standish. I'm the co-founder of Open Door, and we create community living spaces. This house was built in 1910 after the earthquake by a San Francisco family that moved over to Oakland. So there's a bunch of tufted leather couches and velvet chairs and stuff like that that kind of goes with the house.
It's pretty awesome that you get to live somewhere called a manor.
The hassle of getting an apartment, furnishing an apartment, cooking dinner, taking out the trash, all of that, actually, when you do have a larger group, you get to have an easier lifestyle in some senses.
How much does it cost to live in one of these houses?
The houses are similar to what you would pay if you rented a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment with roommates. So in the Bay Area, that means anywhere from $800 to $1,500 a month, or around $1,000.
How then do you make money? If the rent is comparable, what's the business model?
It's pretty straightforward. We're basically a property manager or a landlord. We've done different financial models for each of our properties. So we've done a master lease, we've bought a building and renovated it, and we've been sort of a property manager.
Are you profitable?
Yeah, all of our houses are profitable.
Ian Evans, I'm 31 years old, and I've been in this house for 3 months.
What's hard about it? What's hard about living here?
I like a lot of privacy. I think that's something that I feel like could be challenging in situations where you don't really want to share everything.
What would you say is the number of passive-aggressive notes left during any given week? Because come on, there have to be some.
Zero. We've been using Slack. There's like a little channel that we have, which is breakdowns.
Do you ever like you go into your separate rooms and then you Slack each other? I mean, are you communicating all night on Slack?
No, it's just that everybody's busy and like in different places.
How many structures are there and how does it work within a group?
We've been in the habit of doing a meeting every 2 weeks. There's an agenda, we'll go through it, and most of the time it's sort of a proposal-based.
Sounds like work. You make it sound like an office.
Honestly, I think it is actually very helpful for some soft skills at work also, because at work you're constantly dealing with personalities and different challenges.
Grits. The grits came out nice.
So did they have a pause?
They did, yeah.
Nice.
Mm.
Oh my God, we're all system stinkers.
Another company in the co-living game is WeWork, the co-working startup. It just announced WeLive, sort of a residential version of the working thing. People can rent places by the month or even the day. I interviewed co-founder Miguel McKelvey about the company's co-living plans. You can hear that full interview in my weekly audio column, The Dispatch, over at marketplace.org. This final note before we go, the whole world has got problems. You just heard some of them. Workers' rights, illegal fishing, how not to exploit poor people. And that's just today's show. The list is pretty much endless, which is why the MacArthur Foundation is announcing a new program today that will award a $100 million prize to someone who can solve a big global problem. That's it. Come up with a big global problem and a solution that actually helps people. And those are pretty much the only rules. The foundation will reward one entry with what it hopes will be enough money to actually get something done. And it might just be crazy enough to work. And that's it. That's our show for tonight. Today, the Dow was up 48 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ rose 19 points, 0.4%. And the S&P 500 gained 5 points, about 0.25%. John Buckley, Deirdre Dupke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Molly Wood. Have a great night, and don't worry, Kai Rizdahl is back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.